All right, well, welcome. All right. Well, we're starting a new Equip series tonight entitled Disillusioned. This is our focus for the fall, that this disorienting reality we currently find ourselves in. That's what we're going to be talking about. Partially because I'm a pessimist. We were just talking about some people who first came to our church in the middle of Ecclesiastes, as I was preaching through Ecclesiastes, and it was a bit of a shock, like, what kind of church is this? But it's important for us to address and look at all aspects of life, not just to kind of try to cheer and kind of champion the joy and the fun, but also to be honest about the difficult things that are going on. And so before I start laying out some of the reasons why we are experiencing sort of what we're experiencing right now, I feel like I need to do a little bit of work simply to defend my thesis. And my thesis is this, that we are living through sort of a combination of factors which makes it more difficult to feel at home in the world than usual. So to begin, I want to look at a number of statistics. The first one comes from the World Health Organization. They've reported that anxiety and depression rates have risen 25% over the last 2 years. Second comes from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which shows that the number of overdose deaths went up from 70,000 to 92,000 between 2019 and to 2020, and then up to 109,000 in 2021. So from 70,000 to 109,000 in 2 years. The CDC tells us that suicide rates went up 30% from 2000 to 2018. They actually had a two-year kind of decline plateau, but now they've risen another 5% over the last 2 years. Now, those statistics don't tell a complete story, but these are what are called desperation metrics. They help us to create a picture of how people are feeling towards their lives. And what we see is that people are struggling to feel like they belong. This is what leads to depression and anxiety. They're trying to escape their pain through drugs and suicide at a much higher rate than in the past. Now, the optimists among us might say that a lot of things are getting better too, right? Be positive. Technology is creating new things every day. Medicine is curing things, and so there are ailments that used to be a death sentence that now are just a quick procedure to fix. Now, the number of people in poverty nationally and across the world is going down. And these are all true. And so these are all things that we should celebrate, that we should be thankful for. But while affluence and standard of living seem to be continually rising, human beings, and the American population in particular, are finding it more difficult to be at peace and to find hope. And so what we see is that our physical lives in many ways are improving, but our psychological self is declining at roughly the same rate. Now, most of you here are not dealing with deep depression and substance abuse, but there are signs of this disconnect in all of our lives. We feel it as kind of an unexplainable fatigue that makes some tasks that used to be easy now seem very difficult. There's a lack of motivation at times to take part in community events. Sometimes it manifests as just kind of a general lack of purpose, feeling like you're just kind of getting through the day, to get through the week, to get through the months. For some, it's just kind of this growing sense of loneliness and fear as the world just sort of seems against you. Earlier this year, we had Jenny Black here. She spoke on media trauma. One of the things that she said really did stick with me. She said this, "In years past, when people came to me as a counselor, they would come with an idea of what was wrong with them. They would rattle off a list of symptoms and expect me to give them answers to their problems. But over the last 5 years, people have begun to come to me with no idea what is wrong. Just sort of this overall sense of anxiety and depression." Now, if you were with us for that seminar, you know she chalked a lot of that up to media trauma, which is the concept that our continual connection to media actually produces a slow drip of trauma into our system. Now, if you know my thoughts on smartphones, you know I agree with that. I am the one who invited her to be here, after all. But this media trauma is only part of what's going on. Right, in the last 2 to 3 years have added some additional layers and have helped us to kind of see a bit more of the picture. Because the last few years have kind of been just one shot after another, right? Just kind of one thing after another. And many of us desperately want to move past it. Some of us have tried to kind of even step ahead of that and just kind of make everything okay. And yet when the dust settles, we look around and things still seem off. The new normal is not something that we kind of understand or find ourselves at home in. We keep trying to make it okay by filling our time with good things, but most days it feels like we're kind of losing this battle, or at least struggling through it, that things just don't quite feel right. I think this was summed up well by a pastor I was just talking to the other day. He said, "I just kept going and trying to solve the next problem and stay afloat until one day I stopped and realized that I'd been running on fumes for some time and just needed to face all the struggles that I was avoiding by staying busy." Now, there are times that just keep moving forward where you just kind of have to put your head down and keep moving. But there's times when we need to stop and actually acknowledge the struggle. And so that's what this Equip series is for. We're going to try to understand where we find ourselves so that we can chart a course forward. Now, in one sense, I want to just simply acknowledge that kind of this disillusionment exists. Because one of the things that kind of pushes people from struggle to despair is the feeling that they're alone, that they're the only ones who are experiencing it, that everyone else seems to be okay, everyone else is comfortable, and yet somehow I'm not figuring it out. And so I want to start by just saying that's not the case. There is something unique about this moment that is challenging for everyone. And we have to acknowledge that so we can apply the right solution to the problems that it is creating. Now, the reason why this moment, I think, is so difficult is because this moment is not stable. Right, I made this comment in a church meeting a bit ago, that usually in times of transition, we're moving from one solid thing to another. People have decided that something is better, so we have to kind of leave this to go to that. Think of it as crossing a stream, right? You're jumping from one stone to another. You leave one solid thing to go on to another. But right now, there's not a defined goal. Right now, culturally, there's no next stone. And so we're sort of leaving the solidity of what has been, what we know, without really being sure of where to put our foot down next. Our culture is committed to change without really having any clarity of where we are going. And so this shuffle from one purpose to another at an alarming rate is sort of a whiplash occurs from all the constant shifting. One of the chapters in the book that the men just went through is called Plastic People, Liquid World. And I think this idea of a liquid world is a good way of thinking about it. Right? It's hard to stand on solid ground when everything is liquid. And so what we tend to do when we can't make sense of the world around us is we turn insular. We look for safety and protection in our individual selves. But it isn't just each of us individually who is doing this. We live in a world where every person is operating from sort of this every person for yourself mentality. We have no shared concept then about what we're trying to accomplish. What is true, what is right, changes from person to person. And so what I want to do tonight is look at kind of five aspects of this culture that help provide the framework for disillusionment. And these five pillars are both consequences of this cultural moment, but they're also the character of it. In other words, we have created these realities, but they're also the realities that are kind of who we now are, and they keep feeding our struggle. So my hope is that by identifying these five, we can begin to think about them. We can then begin to think about how to work against them, or at least to work in spite of them. So let's get into it. The first thing that I want to talk about is the deconstruction of institutions. Now, I stole this directly from the book that we went through, so any of the men who were at the men's study are kind of like, is he going to just say five things that we already talked about? No, just this one. But I think that the breakdown of institutions is such a huge part of what we're dealing with, and I think it's especially one that's very easy for us to get on board with. It's very easy for us to look at kind of the structure and the institutions and go, man, yeah, the authority and some of these groups have done really terrible things. We've been bombarded with all the bad things done by the government and the churches and the authority structures. And so it's easy for us to imagine a society thriving by freeing everyone from sort of the abusive constraints of the establishment. Now, before I point out the problem with this, let me be very clear about what I mean when I use the term institution. An institution is an organization that operates based on a specific set of laws, practices, and customs for the sake of maintaining relationships and accomplishing a goal. To describe this, let me use the example of a family. Family is an institution. A family has specific roles. You have father, you have mother, you have children. There's laws within the family, right? Children obey your parents. Parents nurture and instruct your children. Husbands and wives love one another, sacrifice for one another. We have customs, right? Customs might be different from family to family. You have things like family dinner. You have the traditions in how you celebrate the holidays. Kind of even a structure and organization to your home life. And there's a shared goal. The shared goal of family is to provide support and love and affection and belonging. By the way, this is a terribly simplified description of what a family is, but what you can see there is there's all of these pieces. That's what makes up what a family is. Now many families don't honor that structure, but that's kind of my point. At one time, there was a shared understanding of what the family was and what it was supposed to do. So much so that you could look at a family that wasn't doing these things and you could say, that is not a healthy family. Now, it wasn't that every family was exactly the same, though there were, I would say, some traditions defined these things too narrowly and caused unnecessary harm. But what we had were guardrails. There was a standard that could be held up, both for correction, but also for direction. Now, this isn't the case anymore. We've sort of culturally gutted the idea of men's and women's roles. Any guidance for how husbands and wives should act is gone. We've now elevated the autonomy of the child to the extent that children are now being told not to listen to their parents, that they have freedom in themselves, that the parents have no role in their lives. Parents often now aim to become best friends with their kids rather than those tasked with training, instruction, and discipline. I call this the Gilmore Girls syndrome. Come on up a little bit. What we have then is simply a loosely connected group of people who spend some part of 18 years together and then sort of get to choose what kind of commitment they have after that. And you see this where once the children leave the nest, there is little to no guidance as to what their interaction with their family looks like anymore. Now, this is happening in the church as well. This isn't just something that's out there. As much as we have a much more complete idea of what the family is, there is a very strong pushback to anyone speaking into how another person has chosen to parent. And I can tell you that because I have tried. And so we have this idea of sure, there are standards, but don't bring your standards to me. Don't tell me what to do. Now, this is not a complete deconstruction, but we've sort of chosen to smudge out some of the teachings of the Bible, and this removes the consistent standard that allows us to correct one another and fill in the blind spots, right? Because we're given to one another to help each other through this, and yet, again, most of the time, the general idea is there are things you just don't talk about. Don't tell me how to parent my child. I see this in marriage counseling all the time, where I spend a good deal of my time defining the biblical vision of marriage so that we can have a unified goal from which to point out what needs to change. Because usually when people come in, not always, but a lot of times it's kind of like we don't have an understanding of what we're even trying to do, and so we don't have a way of saying, are we doing it well or not? Now, institutions are not just important because they help form a collective purpose. They also give us the structure from which to define ourselves. Right? In Genesis chapter 2, God said it is not good for people to be alone. This points to the fact that we need others to help us understand who we are. God's response to this is to create a complementary helper for Adam, a person who is more like Adam than the animals, but still quite different than Adam. These differences help to define both what Adam is and what Adam is not. In Genesis, we see then God puts Adam and Eve in a place. He puts them in the garden. The garden helps to define for Adam and Eve sort of their place in this world, where they belong. So much so that when they are removed from the garden, that is a harsh thing, right? They are now people who live outside the gates. A bit later in the book, in the covenant with Noah, we see God institute government when he gives Noah the authority to basically punish those who take a life. To make a reckoning or reconcile when someone kills someone or removes life from them. What God is saying in this is that the human institution of government is part of the outworking of the cultural mandate. Government is part of what it means to fill the earth and subdue it. This is the building of culture. And so the nations that we live in, with its laws and customs and its governance, this has a large impact on how we understand who we are. In Exodus, God then comes down and basically gives the people a law, right? He institutes a theocracy for his people. Part of this law codifies the rituals. This is what my people are going to do. This is who my people are going to be. Part of this law is about how to worship God. And so since Eden, since sin came into the world, we see that there are all these structures that have been put into place to help us understand our relationship to God, to help us understand what it means to worship Him. What begins at Sinai then becomes the tabernacle worship, becomes the temple, becomes the church. And the institution of the church then is part of the God-ordained structure for people to understand themselves in relation to God. But also, it's helping them to understand their place in the world. Now, in our men's study, we saw these three institutions, nation, church, and family, singled out as essential to our understanding of who we are. So these are not just ways that we kind of identify ourselves when people ask. They form for us a narrative of what it means to be a good citizen, a good community member, a good brother and sister in Christ, a good husband, a good wife, a good child, a good parent. They sort of fill in the spaces to remind us and help us know who we are and where we belong. Now, I want to add one more institution to this list, and that is our places of work. Right, again, in creation, God does not just make human beings, He gives them a job. And jobs existed, work existed before the fall. So, sorry, work is not just a result of sin. Right? He tells them to be fruitful, to subdue, to tend, to care for. This work and the people that we work with or co-labor with are a huge part of our life, and that's very true in terms of the percentage of time that we spend at work as compared to other things in our waking hours. Now, while we often identify ourselves by what we do, at an even deeper level, our work provides us with a relational community bound by communal and common efforts. Now, I add the institution of work not just because I think it would be nice to be in there or I think it's kind of interesting, but these are the four institutions that are the ones that Paul gives guidance to in the New Testament, right? So if you look throughout the New Testament, Paul is constantly going like, all right, employers, employees, this is how you should treat one another. Church, this is how you should live with one another. This is how you should respond to the governing authorities. This is how you should live within the place that God has put you, right? Husbands, wives, parents, children are all given direction. And God gives us this direction not only to help us have a good government, church, family, and places of work, but to show us that investing in these things, in His way, helps us to understand ourselves as human beings. This is how we know who we are and where we belong. These relationships help humanize us and form our sense of belonging. Now, the reason why we're talking about all of this, all of these institutions, is to address that they're crumbling, that they're deconstructing, that they're falling apart. All of the institutions we talked about are far less trusted in our culture than they have been in times past. People have decided to try to make sense of the world without these things. And I had a whole thing about how church, how family, how government have been deconstructed, but I think that you can kind of fill in the blanks on that, and I don't have to show you how all of that looks, but this leaves many people with a confused understanding of how they fit into their local community, how they fit into their nation. Most people now distrust almost all authority over them. Every single poll that goes out about how people feel about the government is like, 20% trust the government, the other 80%, not so much. The church is now treated as something to be consumed as needed. The family is kind of these people that I'm forced to be in a relationship with without any real specific responsibility towards. Work is how I fill 8 to 10 hours a day so I can go home and do what I want. So we've lost an understanding of what these things are and how we relate to them. Now, this relationship to our institutions only weakens them, and as it weakens them, it actually makes them fail more and ultimately be more abusive, which gives us more proof that they're not worth us giving our time to. And what this does is it puts the whole weight of defining our existence on our own shoulders. Because if we don't get a sense of who we are from our nation, from our church, from our family, from our work, and from the other people in this, then it becomes up to us to construct our own identity. And without these pillars, we don't really have the tools to build that. And so people are flailing all around trying to justify themselves in very earthly ways all around us. And one of the ways that people have done this, and this is my point number two, is they have pushed to the extremes. If we don't have a clear idea of who we are, and if we've been discipled in the language of deconstruction, then we'll begin to define ourselves by what we are not. And we see this happening as people are kind of taking on more and more extreme positions in order to kind of distance themselves from the cultural other. Now, this approach to defining yourself comes from lacking a coherent worldview, which is to say, if we have a clear lens from which to understand the world around us, one that is especially defined from outside of ourselves, then everything in the world can be measured in relation to absolute truth, which means when someone says or does something, it doesn't matter who that person is or whether we like them, truth is truth, right? And so it would go through a filter that doesn't take all of that into account. But when I'm the sole source of my identity, then my relationship to any truth statement is going to affect how I receive it, which means I will believe things, I will accept things, primarily because they benefit me. I want to believe things that make me look good or that help me along in this world. Whether they're true or not, I really don't care. That makes me feel better about myself, so I will believe that that is true. Conversely, we will very quickly disbelieve things because it belongs to those people that we don't want to be identified with. I will reject ideas that either don't affect me or that it benefits me to not believe. And when the group that I want to belong to continues to demonize the alternative and sort of tax further and further to the extreme, I'll follow them in fear of being kicked out or canceled. Because I want to belong. I want to have a place in this world. And so I'll follow the mob. And this mob mentality obscures all that we share and hold in common as we clamor to define ourselves in relation to a group, but even more in contrast to that other group. Now, this has become very clear to me in debate. If you know me, I like to debate people, have good back and forth. And one of the very common ways that people debate now is called whataboutism. This is the process of answering a question not with a positive assertion, not by saying, well, this is what I believe, but with an accusation at the other side, right? What do you think about what's happening right now? Yeah, well, Trump did this, right? What do you think about this? Well, your guy did that first. That's right, Brian, you're always on top of it. What about it? Now, in one sense, politicians have been doing this sort of mudslinging for a very long time. We shouldn't be too surprised by it. But it's gotten to the point where, I mean, half the time, I don't even know what these people stand for. I only know what they're against. And a bit closer to home, this may even be true of ourselves. We may be more sure of what we hate than what we love. Now, this is detrimental to society because a society is held together by what we share. Right? So we may disagree with someone about how to achieve peace, but we should all agree that peace is a good thing. I may not have the same political views as my neighbor, but we should have the same kind of concern for the street we live on. We may even find that someone we dislike is a good father and husband. This allows us to sort of celebrate part of them and how they make the world a better place, even as we wish some other things about them would change. Seeing this overlap helps us to sort of push away our disgust response. Now, when I say disgust response, I'm talking about kind of the, I'm trying to think of the right word, the influence that disliking or hating something can have. Psychologist Jonathan Haidt writes about this a lot. He's pointed to how disgust can be one of the most powerful influences on how we respond. In other words, we're more powerfully pushed from what disgusts us than we are pulled to what attracts us. And one of the major reasons why we pull to the extremes is we're allowing what we don't want to be affiliated with to have more bearing than our beliefs of what we want to be. Now, the opposite of this pull to the extremes is what has been called holding the center. This comes from a 1919 poem by William Butler Yeats. And it says this, "Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed in everywhere. The ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, and while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Now, the point here is not that everyone needs to be more centrist in their ideology, though I honestly don't think it would be the worst thing in the world. No, the argument is that there's a center. There's a unifying core of who we all are. And if we lose sight of that, as he says, all things fall apart. Anarchy is loosed upon the world. Violence is unleashed. Innocence is drowned out. And we lack conviction and are driven by passion alone. That's the result of choosing to feed our disgust. This leads to my third aspect, that there's been a move from relationship to ideology. As I said, one of the things that allows us to become extreme in dehumanizing of the other is a dehumanizing of the other. But soon we begin to kind of think of people as a nameless, faceless entity. Which is to say, I can dislike someone who is cruel, but we are justified in hating someone who we call evil. And so as we become less reliant on others, as we live more and more of a life separated, it's easy for us to detach what someone believes from who they are. Now, every single one of us wants to be defined as a complicated person, as a deep person full of many layers. But we tend to respond to other people by a set of reductions. Right? What's your political affiliation? Did you get the vaccine? How do you feel about the Black Lives Matter movement? It isn't that these aren't part of who a person is. That does make up a piece of who they are. But it's such a small part. As we said before, people are a network of relationships more than they are a collection of ideas. And when we're willing to imagine the whole of who another person is, it keeps us from reducing people to an ideal. This reminds me of one of my favorite quotes from A Tale of Two Cities. I put this online today because I looked it up and then I was like, I'm sharing it. Beginning of one of the chapters, this is what he says, a wonderful fact to reflect upon that every human creature is constituted to be, that profound secret and mystery to every other. A solemn consideration when I enter a great city by night, that every one of these darkly clustered houses encloses its own secret, and every room in every one of them encloses its own secret, that every beating heart in the hundreds of thousands of breasts there is, in some of its own imaginings, a secret to the heart nearest it. So instead of taking a look as he's coming into the city and going like, a bunch of buildings, there must be a bunch of people here, he's going, behind each and every one of those buildings, behind each and every one of those lights is a person, and a person who we can barely begin to know. The secret and mystery of other people can only be experienced in relationships. And as this complexity is discovered, just a little bit at a time, when people are not in a relationship, then they fill in the gaps of another person's character. They imagine something themselves. I saw this full force for about 3 months in 2020 as we were not meeting as a church. Seems like a long time ago now, doesn't it? I'm glad it seems like a long time ago. But there were some tensions that arose during that time in our church. And not based on any sort of interactions, but based on online arguments. And it was amazing how quickly people who knew each other's families, had done things together, quickly forgot this and began to judge one another based on a single issue alone. Motives were quickly created. So not only were they going, oh, now this person is reduced to this idea, then they were like, and I know why they said that. I don't know why I did it like that. Yeah. Jason, sorry if I... Now, people wanted me to come in and solve the issues for them, and I basically said, I'm not going to come between this. The issue will actually be solved if the two of you sit in the room together. Because what needs to actually happen is you need to spend time with each other as families. You need to get your kids together. You need to remember that that's another human being, not just an idea. But it's not just about being in the presence of other people, though that's a big part. It's also choosing to engage with people in a way that refuses to reduce and dehumanize them. I think a perfect example of this is the relationship between Anton Scalia and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I don't know if you've heard about this, but they were probably on the Supreme Court, the two opposite ends ideologically. But they knew each other as people, co-workers. Smart, funny, witty, lovers of opera. Right? They actually went to and performed at one of the operas together, which is kind of funny. They vacationed together. They had this deep friendship that spanned decades, even though they continued to disagree with each other on how to rule from the bench. And some of their dissents against each other were powerful. But one article recounts a visit with Scalia saying the justice had just bought 24 roses for Ginsburg's birthday. So 24 roses were being delivered to her. And the guy wrote the article questioned why Scalia would make such a big purchase. He said, what good have all these roses done for you? Name one 5-4 case of any significance where you got her vote. And Scalia answered, some things are more important than votes. And that is important to remember. Some things are more important than ideology. This leads us to the fourth consequence and characteristic of this age, which is an onslaught of information. When ideology has been heightened and the individual is the lens by which it must be read, then our connection to what is going on all over the world at all times becomes overwhelming. Right? Because we not only have an unlimited supply of information at this point, but we are expected to somehow make sense of it all. Now, in times past, the information that we had was limited. It was confined by space. Not only would it take time for news to travel, but there was kind of language barriers and cultural barriers, which made it so people over here didn't really care what was going on over here. There wasn't a way to even make sense of it necessarily. But technology has blown the doors off of all that. Here's a quote from the book Technopoly on how this whole process works. It says, Technology increases the available supply of information. As the supply increases, control mechanisms are strained. Additional control mechanisms are needed to cope with this new information. When additional control mechanisms are themselves technical, they in turn further increase the supply of information. When the supply of information is no longer controllable, a general breakdown of the psychic tranquility and social purpose occurs. Without defenses, people have no way of finding meaning in their experience. They lose their capacity to remember and have difficulty imagining reasonable futures. Now, who here has read the book Technopoly? No. Okay. So this book was written in 1992, and it is, Amusing Ourselves to Death was written by the same guy, and he just has this way of looking down kind of the timeline, and kind of going, this, if we keep this up, this is where it's going. And what's interesting is, this is exactly what's happened. Right? We created a means to supply all of the information of the world to everyone at all times. Of course, some of that info is twisted, and some of that info is an outright lie. And since we don't have the ability to kind of filter this on our own, people have demanded that technology solve the problem. You need to make sure we don't get false information. So what did the technology do? Fact checkers. Right? Of course, now the fact checkers have to be fact checked, right? And pretty soon, people either gravitate toward the truth that they believe and want to believe, or they just throw their hands up and say, there is no truth, we're never going to find out, and they stop looking for truth at all. More information does not bring hope, it brings chaos. Now this book goes on to sort of connect the chaos of information to the destruction of institutions that we mentioned earlier. Here's what he says. He says, social institutions of all kind function as control mechanisms. That is important to say because most writers on the subject of social institutions do not grasp the idea that the decline in the force of institutions makes people vulnerable to information chaos. To say that life is destabilized by weakened institutions is merely to say that information loses its use and therefore becomes a source of confusion rather than coherence. Right? He goes on to say then that the way that institutions give information a use, the way that they actually kind of hone it in for us, is by telling us what information to engage with and what to avoid. Now, some people would think of that as controlling. Right? Some people would think of that as sort of keeping people from the whole truth. But instead, what codes and creeds and laws and institutional purposes do is filter out all of this information so we can make use of it. Information on its own is just a pile of unconnected facts. We need something to connect them to make sense of them. We need a way of sort of trusting and applying this information so that we can figure out what is actually of use and what is really not worth worrying our pretty little heads about. Because what staring at all of the information all of the time does is it paralyzes us. It makes it so we're unable to even take in any of it. And as Putnam says here, we have difficulty imagining reasonable futures. That's our fifth point. The fifth thing that is really affecting us right now is we have an insecure future. Now, the idea of an insecure future has both a psychological but also a physical reality to it. From the standpoint of the psychological, if the world is liquid, if it's shifting without any aim or purpose, then what reason would any of us have to invest in anything? Why would we sacrifice for some future good when the future is not promised, when we don't even know where it's going, when we might be investing all of our time in something that never happens? Why put your effort into building something if the deconstructivist mindset is just going to tear it down? It is difficult to impossible to imagine reasonable futures, and this makes it hard for us to do anything but live for the moment, because anything but the moment is not promised. The physical part of this is that our future really is unsure. I would say more so than in some other times in our life. People are talking about civil war. Don't know if that's really going to happen, but the fact that it's a believable conversation is not something that most of our lives we've had to think about. There's some sort of recession coming. We don't know when. It kind of depends on what the Fed does, but there's something coming. The culture is shifting away from Christian morality and even against Christians. And no one quite knows how far that will go. We might be at the end of that. We might have a long ways to go. This, more than anything, I think, plays into the idea of feeling lost in the world. Because if we were sure what the world was, we could sort of find a way to make our way in it. As it is, we're kind of stuck trying to pin down a liquid world. And as Christians, we can't just go with the flow because we actually have something concrete that we believe in and are trying to live out. So let me recap everything we've been through. Many of us are both part of the critical deconstructive age and yet are trying to be part of the institutions that are crumbling around us. And even if you choose to invest and be part of establishing, it's an uphill battle. It feels like you're working against gravity. Many of you also are feeling of the pull to the extremes. Either trying to make sense of how so many of your friends are sort of on the opposite extreme, like, how did we get so far away? I thought we were kind of on the same page for most of our lives. Or you're sitting in the middle feeling like you have no home because everyone seems to be running one way or the other. In the last few years, people have left churches, families have been thrown into turmoil, and many friendships have not survived this pull. And so holding the center is going to seem like you're on the other side to many people. Not joining them where they go will make you seem like you are the other. Also, as Christians, we're going to be continually judged, categorized by a few Christian doctrines, right? Mostly the Christian sexual ethic. Know this already. If you hold to what the Bible says, people will view you through a couple of ideological points. Some people will get to know you as people, but many won't. Some of you maybe have already experienced this as you've just kind of been dismissed from either groups or even from relationships you already had because you stand in a different spot than people on one or two points. Being misunderstood then makes us feel like we don't have a place. Fourth, the onslaught of information continues to create chaos as people have no way to decipher what is true from what is not. What's important from what isn't. And while the institution of the church gives us some framework for that, certainly, it means that we are going to dismiss some things that other people think are important. We're probably going to be seen as narrow-minded or dismissive to some. And so what is necessary to avoid chaos and maybe even for our own mental health is going to alienate us from many people in the culture. And finally, the trajectory of our culture seems to be moving away from us. Not moving away in a direct line. It's more of a spiraling. But we feel unable to stop it. We don't really know where it's going, and that makes it really hard to figure out where we fit into that. Are we supposed to fight it? Are we supposed to kind of just stay off to the side and stay safe? Like, what is our place? And I'd say all of this contributes to our disillusionment. Now, the easy answer would be just be a good Christian, right? But what we're talking about is how following God is becoming something different than it has ever been in our lifetimes. So over the next 2 weeks, we're going to talk about how to think about our Christian identity. That's next week. How to apply a Christian worldview to all that is changing. That's the week after. And then in week 4, we're going to come back together to talk about where to go from here. So I'm totally going to leave today just here. I think it's actually good for us to just kind of sit in this for a little while, to just think about it. What is happening in the world around us? How are we contributing to it? Now that we've begun to understand why things are difficult, right? How should we respond?